Just picking up on something that Maria said, there is a little amendment to the Transport Accident Act. I think it's section 128 capital A, or it's around that area, which deals with the aspect of implied undertakings. So it's actually dispensed with that rule insofar as it applies to Transport Accident Act cases. And there's something also somewhere hidden in the amendments to the Accident Compensation Act. So we don't be confronted in Transport Accident Act cases and Accident Compensation Act cases with problems with implied undertakings, not to the extent as we used to. What I'd like to talk about this morning is what I call a fireside chat, which is just to give you some examples of problems that can arise in jury trials, and hopefully, by giving you some of those examples, steps to avoid those problems. And the first thing that we come across is impaneling a jury. And for those of you who have had the opportunity to impanel juries on occasions or many occasions, please excuse me because I'm going back to basics here. And I'm addressing this part of the presentation to people who haven't had any experience in jury trials at all, so that they can have an understanding of what happens at the very beginning of a jury trial. As Maria said, it starts off, one of the things is that the judge is provided with a written list of proposed witnesses. And as Maria indicated to you, the reason that that's done is to make sure that none of the jurors have any knowledge of or any involvement with any of the proposed witnesses. And that can be a real issue, particularly in country circuits, where there are only a certain number of medical practitioners and they may have treated the plaintiff or they may have given a medico-legal opinion. So it's important to make sure there's nothing, no contact or no relationship of any sort between a potential witness and a juror. So what happens is with the jury trial is there is a jury pool, and that's a pool of citizens from the local area, and they're under the care of a jury keeper. Sounds very quaint, but there's someone who looks after them. And one of the reasons that that occurs is so that there's no contamination of the jury pool with us ordinary mortals and the legal profession in general. So when you've got a jury, assume that we've got one defendant, one plaintiff. 12 people are selected from a jury pool. And they're called out. They have to stand up in the body of the court and all of the practitioners turn around from the bar table and eyeball them. And, you know, they have to stand there and pretend they're not looking at anyone or not embarrassed. But at the time they're called out, you're given their name and their occupation. And most of us use a score sheet and we'll write down an age, the name, female, male, occupation, and a score, usually out of 10. And that's important because you compare it with the other people in your team when it comes to striking people off the list. So you've got your 12 fortunate or unfortunate individuals who have been picked. I'll go back a step. Before that, when the jury pool is brought into the room, the judge will give a description of what the case might involve, and we'll ask whether there are any people who are unavailable to sit for the duration or need to be excused. He or she will do that after they've been told by the practitioners how long they anticipate the trial might take. And you might find that people might have medical reasons or other reasons that they ask to be excused. The judge will consider it and will either excuse them or not. And I find, as a matter of practicality, it's always, I think, important to note those who have asked to be excused and who have not been excused, because you might have a lingering resentment from that juror if they actually get on the jury panel or get on your actual panel. And so I might make a little note very quickly about the list of the people who've been excused, and I'll tick them or cross them out or something to indicate whether they remain in the pool. So you get the 12, they've all been eyeballed, you've got your score sheet, and so what happens? There's a quick little conference between counsel and the solicitor as to who they do want and who they don't want, because you have the opportunity to strike three off the list each to end up with your ultimate jury of six. And again, some of the comments I might say might seem really obvious or really trite, but one of the things that's very important is to make sure you've got your whole legal team there when your jury's been impaneled. And the reason for that is, as I experienced on one occasion, there might be a member of the legal team who's known to one of the jurors. It might seem improbable, but I'll give you this example. Impaneled a jury on late one afternoon, there was for the defendant, senior counsel, myself, instructing solicitor. On the other side, there was senior counsel and instructing solicitor. The junior counsel was involved in something else and wasn't there at whatever time it was, 3:30 in the afternoon. We impanel a jury. A short opening, hasn't been completed. We retire for the day. The next day, everyone turns up, including the junior counsel for the plaintiff. And the juror who has been appointed the foreman instantly writes a note to the judge, there's a problem. Unbeknown to the junior counsel for the plaintiff, that juror's wife had been represented by that member of counsel in an injury case the year before. And that member of counsel had interviewed the man, the husband, for the purpose of him giving evidence in that case. Might sound very remote that those stars would align at the same time, but the jury had to be discharged, we had to start again. So there's an example of making sure that, as best you can, that your legal team is there and part of the process of impanelling. And how do you impanel a jury? I think everyone would agree, to a certain extent, it's an instinctive reaction. You know what your case is about, and you will have discussed, presumably, with your team, what sort of people you want in a jury. Sometime you might, for various reasons, opt for a certain age group, a certain gender, or whatever it might be, and you'll try and fit that profile. You've only got a few seconds to make these decisions, and that's why I think the score sheet's helpful. And as I said, you finish your score sheet and then you confer. If you've got a leader, you confer with your leader and with your instructing solicitor. And then you have to strike off. The solicitor has to strike off three names. And it's important that in those few seconds that proper communication is made, because the solicitor for the plaintiff will strike off three names off the list. And then the list is handed over to the solicitor for the defendant. And when you're for the defendant, you have a look to see who the plaintiff has crossed out. And then you as solicitor, cross the three names out that you've agreed. There have been instances where people have struck out the wrong name and struck out inadvertently one of the people that everybody wanted on that jury. That's just too bad. You can't go back and say, sorry, I made a mistake. That's your jury. That's who you've got to deal with. The jury then retires to appoint a four-person, a four-man or four-lady. And David was talking before about being at the conference hearing the story about the score pointing as to who could make the witness say, I didn't come here to be insulted. I have a little game that I play which I call Foreman Lotto. And it's a bit like Chook Lotto, but not quite the same. And we try and work out very quickly which person will be the juror as they go out, which person will be appointed the foreman. And it's really interesting how accurate or inaccurate you can be in that. And, you know, it might only take a minute or two, but you put a little red mark next to who you think the foreman will be, and so do the other people in your team. It might be a bit silly, but it's a bit of levity that we need from time to time. Now, again, these comments might seem self-evident about etiquette in the courtroom. But it's important that no matter who you're appearing for, that a certain amount of etiquette is adopted when dealing with the jury. No contact between the practitioners and the jurors, and obviously that seems self-evident. But there have been examples where that has occurred without any fault on the practitioner's part. An example I can give is in Geelong last year, in a jury case, the end of the first day, I was junior for the defendant. John Tebbett was leading me. We had an instructing solicitor. And we were outside in the foyer of the court. And that's another thing one must take into account, the logistics of the courtroom and the court building that you're in. Because in some courts, there can be inadvertent contact with the juror as you're leaving court or coming into court. And particularly in country courts, you've got to be very, very mindful of it. Anyway, on this particular afternoon, we completed first day's evidence. My instructing solicitor, and I'm sure he won't mind me saying, had very, very, very short hair, very closely cropped, almost shaved hair, and it's relevant for this purpose. There was a juror who we knew was a hairdresser, and we were in the foyer of the court. I was still robed. John Tebbutt was about as far away as where Maria was, and he had just taken his wig off. And the instructor was facing me with his back to the outside world. This female juror came. She walked around the back of my instructing solicitor and in between the two of us and faced him and said, "I would like to cut your hair." The bizarre things happen. And we said, "You're a juror, yes." And my instructor quite rightly said, "I can't speak to you." And we sort of sent her on her way. What do you do in that situation? Right, what you do is you immediately let your opponent know that there's been inadvertent contact, which we did straight away. First thing the next morning, we informed the judge of the contact and the content of the contact, obviously whilst the jurors were still in the jury room. And then the judge had to make a determination as to whether he thought that would influence the course of events and whether he would discharge the jury. But if you're ever faced in that situation, obviously you say, "I can't speak to you." You cut the conversation dead, and then you let your opponents know, and then you let the court know, because that's the only way you can deal with it. So be wary of strange jurors who want to cut your hair. She didn't ask me if I wanted a haircut. She asked someone who had no need for a haircut, so it was very bizarre. But these things can happen. So be very mindful of that, particularly in court, as your behaviour. The tradition is that the plaintiff's team will be placed closest to the jury box. No matter which side you're on, be very careful about what you do with your documents. Don't leave documents open on the bar table when you leave. Don't leave anything that might suggest figures or anything like that on the bar table, because you mightn't think a juror mightn't see it, but all they have to do is glance across and see something. You don't want that happening. You've got to be careful what you say in the courtroom and within earshot of the jurors and how you look at them. Now, of course, there might be some occasions in a trial where there's a joke. Well, everyone's allowed to laugh. But you've got to be careful that you're not seen to be either staring at a juror or somehow trying to influence them. So be mindful of that. Out of court, around the courts, also be very careful. You don't know, and particularly even before you impanel your jury, you don't know whether the person in the lift next to you is part of that jury pool. Be careful in lifts, cafes, and the court surrounds. Be careful of your conversations. We've all heard the expression, "loosely lips sink ships," and it can occur, and it can be, as I said, totally innocent and inadvertent. That's between the practitioners and the jurors. And as responsible, reasonable practitioners, you'd be aware of those problems, and I'm sure you would all conduct yourself appropriately. But what about jurors, litigants, and witnesses? And again, it seems self-evident that there should be no contact between jurors, witnesses, and litigants. But it's not always so. And you'll see in the little summary that we've prepared, we've put in reference to Section 78A of the Juries Act, where, again, something that we would expect to be self-evident now has been enshrined, that a juror must not make inquiries about trial matters. Now, the jurors will be directed by the judge about this, but they are not allowed to make their own independent inquiries. They're not allowed to go and, for example, have their own view or go and read a book or do any other inquiries. And in particular, in this age, they're not allowed to use the internet. And it's enshrined in the legislation. They've given that as an example of using the internet to search an electronic database for information as being prohibited conduct. And again, the judge will direct the jurors as to that. But believe it or not, people do it. And in England last year and this year, there was a case called the Attorney General and Frail, and I've referred to it in the little summary. And it's a Facebook case. And this is quite an extraordinary case, and I'll just give you an outline of it, because it's really just almost mind-boggling that someone would do what Ms. Frail did. Ms. Frail was a juror on a multiple defendant drug charge trial. And the trial went for something like 10 weeks, and there were several defendants. And it was a jury trial, and it went, as I said, it went for a long time. Very expensive trial to run. Evidence went for a long time. The jury went out, and over a series of days, the jury came back and acquitted some people and convicted other people. And in particular, 3 days out, they acquitted a lady called Miss Stewart. And they convicted two other people, but they had a number of remaining defendants. And so the jury was still deliberating. So what this particular juror did was that she contacted Miss Stewart, the defendant that had been acquitted, via the Facebook. And Miss Stewart, whose boyfriend was still being, his fate was still being decided by the jury, responded. And so they had a Facebook dialogue still in the course of the trial. Not only that, Ms. Frail decided that she would do some internet searching about the remaining defendant. And she did it on several occasions. And it was extraordinary the sort of things they were talking about on the Facebook. And they knew, well, I'll leave it to you to decide whether they knew. Frail, in one email or one Facebook entry, said, "Can't get anyone to go either way, no one budging, please don't say anything, because Jamie, they would call a mistrial and I will get blah, blah, blah too." And the defendant wrote, "I know, I've deleted all messages, I wouldn't do that to you, don't worry. Kiss, kiss, kiss," and all this sort of stuff. It was just absolutely bizarre. Anyway, the defendant, Stewart, got an attack of the guilts and she told her legal team, and they told the court immediately. So, of course, the trial was aborted. $9 million it cost up until that time. So Ms. Frail was charged with contempt of court. There was no evidence, and the court accepted, there was no evidence to suggest that there was any sort of conspiracy or an attempt to pervert the course of justice. This lady had decided on her own get-go to contact the defendant, or one of the defendants. The defendant herself should have stopped that and should have done something about it earlier. But anyway, so they were both charged with contempt of court. And Ms. Frail was convicted, and for her efforts, 8 months jail. The defendant who was contacted and continued the dialogue was also convicted, and she got 2 months suspended. And then there was a retrial, and I don't know the result of the retrial. But that is an absolutely extraordinary, extreme end of the spectrum, but it does happen. And now with Facebook and internet and social networking, jurors may well take it upon themselves to undertake these sorts of investigations, inquiries and things, and it can have disastrous effects. We've also put into the summary some material about a matter that happened locally. And the only material I could find was a report in The Age of a juror who contacted a person who, unbeknown to the juror, was a target of a police investigation. And that person's conversations were being taped. And the juror contacted that individual and told him how the trial that he was a juror was in was going and how they were going to acquit and how he was going to do this, that and the other. Again, the trial got aborted and there were proceedings on foot. Now, I can't advise you any further as to the status of those, but I've put, just for a matter of your own edification, a little summary from the newspaper about the circumstances of that. So you can see that there are real examples of inappropriate behaviour from a juror and the consequences. But there's also the inadvertent interaction between a juror and a party. And an example I can give of that is quite a few years ago, a young girl had a nasty accident and injured her leg. She was only about 19 or 20 by the time the trial came along. And on the second or third day of the trial, one of the jurors fell over at lunchtime and broke their ankle. And so they had to get taken to hospital. And, excuse me, we got rolled over to the next day. And on the following morning, the juror came to court in a wheelchair and was being wheeled in. And this young lady, unthinkingly, but unintentionally, in the sense of there was no suggestion of her trying to influence the juror, said, as a lot of people would, "Are you all right?" A normal human reaction to someone who's been injured in circumstances where you've got an involvement with them. But that was inappropriate conduct and inappropriate contact, and so that jury got discharged and the matter proceeded as a cause. Also, I had a case last year where a jury in the Supreme Court was being looked after. I don't know what had happened to the jury keeper on that particular day, but was being looked after by an associate who was inexperienced in jury matters. And when we came back from lunch, the jurors were in the corridor immediately outside the court in two groups. And right in the middle was the plaintiff and his family. Now, there was no suggestion that the plaintiff had orchestrated it or that there was any contact, but that had to be brought to the judge's attention, and he had to make sure the jury keeper, wherever the jury keeper had been, was brought in and came in and looked after the jury and kept them appropriately away from people. Now, the significance of this is that it can lead to a discharge of the jury. Discharge of a jury is a very expensive thing. The English case, $9 million. It's also time-consuming, and when you lose a jury, you might not necessarily get another one, depending on what stage of the trial you're at. So the example I gave you about the legal team not being there in its entirety, we could get another jury because we'd only lost about half an hour, three quarters of an hour. But if you're 3 or 4 or 5 days into a trial, what happens? Well, you can either lose the jury and try and get a new jury. You might not be able to get one. Or the matter will proceed as a cause. And there might be a myriad of reasons why a particular party might not want it to proceed as a cause. But if the jury's lost, that's one of the consequences. There's also issues about who pays the costs if the matter gets adjourned and a new trial has to start. And that will depend on, and all of those circumstances will depend on how the jury got discharged and what was the behaviour leading that caused the application for a discharge. If it was something, say, a defendant had done in cross-examination and put something improperly, well, the defendant, if there are costs, the defendant might wear the costs, or the defendant might lose the right to a jury. If it's something inadvertent about that sort of contact out of court, a different result might arise. I've put in a case of Massard and Bears there. There's a ruling relating to contact between the jurors and the plaintiff on the railway station, down here near court, on two occasions, which was one of the factors that ultimately led to the discharge of a jury. One issue that arises in relation to juries is, well, if the plaintiff has asked for a jury and doesn't pay the jury fees, can the defendant then come in and pay the jury fees and have the matter proceed as a jury? There's a case that I've referred you to of Trevor Roller, Shutter Service and Crow, and that highlights the tension between the Juries Act and the rules, because under the rules, the defendant is supposed to pay the plaintiff the jury fees, and under the Juries Act, the defendant is supposed to pay the fees directly to the pathometry. To sort that out, if you're faced with that problem, you'll need to go back a step and look at whose jury it is and whether it's the rules or the act that apply and what the circumstances are if the jury fees aren't paid. And as a general rule, if the jury fees aren't paid, the other side gets one opportunity to pay the jury fees to keep the jury. But you'll need to look at that very carefully if you are faced with that situation. And David also had a recent experience where I believe the plaintiff requested the jury but just never paid the jury fees, and there was an argument as to whether the defendant could then step in and pay the jury fees either by the end of the first day to keep the jury. So you've got to look at all of those things when you're dealing with juries and when you're in a situation where you might lose your jury how you hold on to them. So be very careful about your behaviour. Understand who it is who's asked for the jury in the first place. And the difficulty with asking for a jury if you're a defendant is that if a plaintiff has chosen at the outset not to have a jury, the defendant's only got 10 days from the time of filing their appearance to put in their request for a jury notice. And that's often a very short period of time. And in some situations, not so much the Transport Accident or Accident Compensation Act matters where there's been extensive pre-trial process has gone through. But in some situations, you have very little information about the incident at the time you've received the writ. So there's hard considerations to go into your thought processes. And I think most defendants would opt for at least putting the jury notice in and keeping their options open, because you can't come back later and say, oh, I should have put the jury notice in, but I didn't, and now I want one. It's at the front end that you have to make your decision. So take all those things into account when you're dealing with juries. Maria has also dealt with with issues about witnesses, and we've put a little bit in about how to avoid a Jones and Dunkel inference, where you've got a witness in your camp and you haven't called them. How do you avoid the inference that they wouldn't give evidence in support of your client's claim? There might be a number of explanations. One might be ill health. You can then get medical material to prove that or to establish that. But if you're silent and there's no reasonable explanation, they might be overseas, there might be a myriad of reasons, but if there's no proper explanation, be very wary, because you will face that inference. There are provisions in the Evidence Act, as Maria mentioned, the exceptions to the hearsay rule, but you've got to be careful, you've got to make sure you've got proper notice. And if it's a situation where the person is available, but you don't want to cause them because it would cause undue expense or delay or not reasonably practicable, the defendant or the opposing party has 21 days to file written objections. That 21 days doesn't apply in circumstances where the witness is unavailable. So where a witness is unavailable, and we've set out what the dictionary says unavailable is for the purposes of the Evidence Act, the party seeking to rely upon that evidence has to serve a notice, but the party wanting to object to that notice doesn't have to give answering notification. So there's a difference between the two. Unavailable, party relying gives notice. Available, but for various reasons might not want to be called, you have to give notice, and the person who wants to oppose that has to give responding objection notice. Finally, just admissions. Again, be wary of or be prepared to face a situation where, for example, if you don't call a medical witness that has examined the plaintiff, that you're asked for an admission that medico-legal examination has taken place. So you'll see with jury trials, there's a lot of interactions, a lot of interweaving components. You're dealing with a group of human beings that you've had no contact with before. When you're impaneling them, it's a very much an instinctive reaction as to whether you want them on your jury or not. Sometimes you'll find within your team there are different views as to whether they should be on or shouldn't be on. And I think the best way to deal with that practically is if someone in the team in those few minutes has a strong feeling either that they don't want someone on the jury or they do want someone on the jury, that should be good enough for everybody. If people are equivocal about it, then that's a different thing. If your scores are under 4 or 5, you probably don't want them on the jury. So I hope that has been some assistance to people when they're considering how to deal with juries. Thank you.